Good morning and welcome to this edition of Upstate Issues, a public affairs presentation of Intercom Communications. This Sunday morning, the Sunday before Halloween, we're going to talk about ghosts and the paranormal and maybe touch a nerve in some of the things that you're interested in. We've got a guest this morning named Catherine Vinson, and Catherine delves into all of this, teaches a course at the Greenville Tech area, has a business, and first of all, Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
As we get into this morning, you know, you're encouraged to give us all the scoop and the stories and everything else on this day before Halloween. But before we get into the ghost lore and the paranormal, let's talk a little bit about you. How did you get interested in this? And give us some idea of your background.
Okay, well, how I got interested in this has sort of been a lifelong fascination of mine. I have had paranormal experiences. As far back as I have memories, so probably starting from age 5 on forward, and for many years of my life, I was sort of in denial of a lot of it because I was terribly frightened by it, and probably about 17 years ago, I set out to find out what was going on, so that's my interest in paranormal. Now, as far as myself, I do work at one of the local technical colleges in the upstate. I'm a training coordinator by day. And outside of that, I'm a mother and a grandmother.
So it sounds like you came to this, as they say, honestly. It was just part of, you know, your life as evolution began. Give us some myths and facts that that people may or may not be aware of.
I think one of the myths is that we're a bunch of thrill seekers just looking for cheap thrills. The fact of the matter is that this is about service to others and how we can help people with their problems. You know, people contact us and oftentimes are frightened or confused about what's going on around them, and they just want answers. So we don't take people's claims lightly. We take everything people take us, you know, tell us at face value, and our mission is to help them.
When someone gets in touch with you, give us an example of kind of a typical overview, but give us an idea of some of the concerns they may have, some of the situations they've experienced that would lead them to get in touch with you and yours.
Oftentimes, people that contact us have things going on either in their home or their business. Maybe, you know, things are being moved that they know they haven't moved. Maybe they're seeing things, sometimes directly, sometimes maybe in my peripheral vision I'm seeing things and I'm not sure what's going on. I'm hearing things, a lot of strange things that they don't understand. They've had you know, maybe sometimes the children or the animals have had experiences and they want explanations because they don't understand what's going on.
Does this happen frequently? I mean, do you get a lot of contacts and people having these problems, or is it often than people would normally think?
I think it happens. I think it's more common than people realize. In the last 3 years, we've probably done close to a couple dozen investigations, and so we fairly frequently have people contact us, and a lot of times we can give people, you know, rational explanations for what's going on, but there's sometimes when we absolutely have to look at the paranormal explanation.
And how do you do that? Someone calls you and says, you know, I've got a house, it's on this side of the city, and I'm beginning to sense things and or feel things. And like you mentioned, you know, there's some things have moved and this and that. What happens at that point from your side as far as, you know, the Q&A process, the validation that you guys have to go through? And then, you know, what is the next step with regards to the investigation process?
Well, normally when people contact us, we discuss it as a group and we determine if the person does indeed need a paranormal investigation. Obviously, if they've got unexplained things going on, we usually do recommend an investigation, and then we go out and try to determine what's going on. We have a very thorough process that we do that usually starts with a client interview. It's a very thorough client interview. We've got about 65 questions on it just to try and find out about what's going on and what people's state of mind is, who's living in the house. It's quite a lengthy process we go through. And then once we have all that information, our case manager is actually the only one that gets that information. The rest of us go in, we go in blind, meaning the only thing we know is that there are claims that have been made. And that's so as not to taint any impressions or feelings that we may get while we're there.
So you try to avoid having any preconceived ideas at that point.
Exactly.
How long does it take from the time you would arrive at someone's property, their home, for example, versus their business, just, you know, a reasonably smaller structure, and then, you know, set your equipment up and then begin to make a determination at first blush if there is or isn't anything to pursue further?
Well, normally we go in and do an investigation based on people's claims, and we make a determination early on as to whether or not we're going to do an investigation. But once we arrive there, while the case manager is doing the interview, the rest of us get everything set up, the cameras and the equipment, and we go about taking base readings and such. Now, you know, smaller place, I think probably the least amount of time we've gotten in and out would probably have been maybe 4 to 5 hours. A much bigger place, of course, is going to take longer. We did have a business in the upstate that we investigated, and it wound up being, I think, 8 hours the first night, and there was so much evidence we asked to come back for a second night, and we were probably there about 6 to 8 hours the second night as well. So it just depends on how big the place is and how much activity is going on, too.
Give us an example of the type of activity you saw at this particular business.
Oh, goodness. We had throughout the investigation things being moved, things unexplained going on. Now, a lot of it are evidence that we get. We don't get it until we get home when we start reviewing the audio recorders and the video and the photos, of course. But while we were there at this particular place, we had a lot of things going on, things being moved. We had at one point a body shop, and we had at one point a very heavy, like kind of like a wash tub, probably weighed, I don't know, 25 pounds, slide off a table that was perfectly level, so which was a little bit startling for us. We were probably all about 15 foot away from it. We had very heavy chains, hoist type chains hanging from the ceiling that all of a sudden started swinging back and forth. Brake discs, which are very heavy items. At one point, there was a stack of them on the floor about four high, and we moved out of that room and heard a very loud clanging noise. Went back in there and saw that one of them had slid off the top. Now, this was, perfectly level, and those things are very heavy. They're not going to just slide all by themselves, and we actually went back and looked at the photos that we had taken in that room, and prior to leaving that room, they were all stacked up nice and neat. So a lot of things went on. Most of the evidence we got on the investigation was, we got afterwards when we got home, started reviewing the audio, video, and photos.
Let's talk about a little about the equipment. I'm assuming that the type of gear that you use is not your standard run-of-the-mill. I mean, some of it may be, but give us an idea of the type of equipment and hardware you bring to bear in an investigation like this.
Well, sure. The standard equipment, would be cameras, camcorders, audio recorders, EMF detectors, which are electromagnetic field detectors, flashlights, batteries, lots of batteries, compass, thermometer, motion detectors. We use carbon monoxide detectors. It's pretty much standard equipment that all helps us gather evidence. And then, of course, our own self.
And so when you go to a paranormal investigation location, whether it's a residence or whatever, give me an idea of the number of staff that show up for something like this.
There are five of us, four of us mainly that are kind of the core group. We have two investigators in training, and then the four of us that are normally the ones that are go on most of the investigations.
So you've got a pretty good crew. How do hate to ask this question, how do some folks react when you show up and you start setting up and wiring a location? I mean, I know they're happy to see you there, or they wouldn't have contacted you. But how was the client's reaction to some of this?
I think mostly interest. They're you know, most of the time they watch what we're doing. Of course, now when we get there and we start setting up, we explain what we're getting ready to do, and usually the client is off in a room with the case manager doing the initial interview. You know, and so they don't usually watch. You know, if there's other people there, we try to not have any more people there than we need. So we do ask, especially if they're small children, we ask that they're, you know, small children not be there during the investigation, just to rule out any excess noise or commotion. But people that do watch us are usually very interested in what we're doing, and they'll ask questions, and what is that, and why are you doing that? And so we try to explain and educate people as we go.
There you go. We talked at the top of the program that you teach a course. And I'd heard of the one at Greenville Tech. Why don't you give us an idea who typically enrolls, how long does the course run, when do they happen, and the material that's covered and any activities that go on?
Okay. Well, the course is Ghost Hunting 101. It's an eight-hour course. And typically, the people that sign up for the course are people who are either interested, maybe in forming their own group, or basically just looking for information so that they can understand better. One of the ladies in one of my classes that ended this week said she wasn't really interested in investigating, but she's had things happen all her life and really wanted to get a better understanding of how to handle those things. So it's kind of a mix of people. Some just curious, you know, some of them are just curious, really don't want to form a group or anything like that. But I teach it at three upstate colleges, and so typically I started this last year, and so I just finished up my sixth class, I believe it was. I've done some in the spring and some in the fall. Of course, October is a good month because that's when all the paranormal stories are going on, and that's that was when I did my first class last year in October. So, but some of the things that go into, as far as the class is concerned, safety is a big one because that's a big issue, and that's one of the things I think mainly people need to know, especially if they're going to get out to do this. There's a lot of things that people are not aware of or don't think about. So safety, of course, is a big concern. And then we go into how to gather evidence. You know, we talk about the equipment and the tools that you use and how to use them, how to gather evidence. And then, of course, we talk about what to do with that evidence. How do you interpret it? What does it mean? You know, some of the things that we get, how do we interpret it? And then, of course, one of the last things I do is for those that are interested in forming a group, how to present evidence to your clients. So
how to present evidence to your client. In other words, to make the case that they were either right or wrong in their suspicions and why that is the case, correct?
Right, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the terminology. I was going through the glossary of paranormal definitions, and some of them are pretty interesting. One of the first ones that jumped out at me was aura. Tell us in your definition, what aura is all about.
An aura it's sort of an energy that surrounds people. Some people can see auras, and some other people can't. But it's sort of an energy field that surrounds a person, I guess, basically.
So those people that are more sensitive than others can oftentimes detect this without even trying to, or anything from that standpoint.
Yes, absolutely.
Talk about automatic writing. When I saw this this definition fleshed out, this was very interesting.
Automatic writing is some people call it a form of divination, meaning it's a tool that can be used. There are some people that believe that spirits from the other side can use you as a medium, so to speak, and write through you. And so people that, you know, do automatic writing claim that this is not coming from them. This is coming from another source, meaning a ghost or a spirit possibly, and they they just sit down and write, and oftentimes they say that they have no idea what they're writing until it's all the session's all over with, and then they will look and see and are amazed at things they've written. Now, I don't have a lot of experience with that, but that's my understanding of automatic writing.
I was wondering about that, if that was rather common or still kind of a little more isolated in occurrence and frequency.
I don't think it's real common these days, although there are people that do that, automatic writing. I think it was more common in the early days of this, you know, spiritualist movement. People were doing automatic writing, I think, probably more frequently back then.
I remember watching the motion picture Ghostbusters, and I'm sure this is not a new thing for you when people reference the inane and the silly. That's mm-hmm. my frame of reference. Ectoplasm. I remember one of the scientists referencing ectoplasm. What is that, and is it even real?
Honestly, ectoplasm, I think, is sort of a gel-like substance that is said to come from possibly be evidence of ghosts and spirits. I've never had any experience with ectoplasm, so honestly, I couldn't tell you what it looks like other than, you know, we saw it on the Ghostbusters movie, but not had a lot of experience with ectoplasm.
I had no idea if that was just a Hollywood made-up term for something some goo they wanted to use. Or
I don't know. Honestly, no, because I've never had any experience with it, and I don't know of anybody that's ever had an experience with it. So I couldn't tell you if it's a real thing or not. A lot of things are possible.
Let's talk a little bit about something that people have heard about but probably don't know a great deal about, particularly in this part of the country. Exorcisms, they seem to be more prevalent in other areas where Catholicism is a larger part of the population. Talk a little bit about, in this area, are they done frequently? Do you know of any success or whatever that's gone on in this particular region of the upstate?
Again, that's something I don't have a lot of experience with. I know that, people usually associate it with the Catholic religion, although it's not strictly a Catholic thing. There are other religions that do exorcisms. And I think the basic idea of an exorcism is to release demons that are supposedly trapped inside of people. I don't know of anybody personally that's ever had that experience. I've heard people talk about it at conferences and such, but I've never known anybody to either have that experience of having an exorcism done on them or doing one on anybody. But I think the basic theory behind it is just to rid people of their demons.
Then let's talk about, we've talked a little bit about hardware and the recorders and whatever. Mm-hmm. Talk about something that I apparently is somewhat controversial in the paranormal area, and that's a Frank's box.
The Frank's box, actually is an extension of something a lot of people don't know, that Thomas Edison did some work in trying to contact, or with regards to making a device that would contact spirits. He firmly believed that was possible. The Frank box is something created by a man named Frank Sumption, and it's a box, and I'm not a real technical person. I leave that to some of the other people in the group, but I think the basic thing is it uses like radio waves, and the theory is that spirits can somehow communicate with you through those radio waves, and it's got a cycling kind of thing that it goes through, and I did have one of the ladies in our group a couple years back attended a conference where there was a fellow that had the Frank's box there, and she did about a 20-minute session with him, and contacted her father, actually, her deceased father, and I videoed it for her while she was doing it. It was a pretty moving emotional experience for her, actually, because she would ask questions, and she said the answers that were given, and you could hear them coming through. You could hear a man's voice speaking, and she said it did sound like her dad. She felt it was her dad talking to her, and the answers that he gave made sense to her. In other words, she asked things that nobody else could have had that information. So it is a controversial thing. It's not a proven science by any means, but there are a lot of people who do believe in you know, the Frank's box being able to communicate with spirits.
You know, over the years I've met people who will tell you they have a higher degree of sensitivity or awareness, that they sense and feel things, you know, that others can't. They may see a color around you. They may put a great deal of store in astrological signs or just any variety of things. Do those components help someone within a paranormal area? Do you put much stock in varying levels of sensitivity, or is it more Absolutely. Scientific?
Yes, we do put stock in those who are sensitive. I am the sensitive or intuitive of the group. I am actually a psychic medium, so I do have sensitive abilities that have actually been validated through our paranormal investigating. Now, because it is not a scientific thing, we don't include it in our conclusions to our clients. We do add it in as here's the impressions of the sensitive of the group, and I give people my impressions. And then, you know, sometimes I'll have impressions or feelings or experiences during the course of an investigation, and we'll get evidence either on EVP or photo evidence to back up the experience I was having. So, yes, we do put stock in it. We do not include it as part of our final conclusion, only so as to when we put it in the report, we say, you know, here are the feelings of the sensitive, and then we put a disclaimer that this is not a part of the scientific conclusions that we have reached, because it's not a scientific thing by any means. Ghost hunting really isn't, you know, we're looking for that. Even though I'm sensitive, I'm still looking for that rock-hard proof that we can give to people. We're very careful about what we label paranormal. And so it is a part of our investigations. Sometimes I'll get a very strong feeling in a certain area, and then we'll concentrate on that area with regards to doing maybe an EVP session in that room or taking more photos or whatever. But it's not part of what we call our scientific evidence. You know, let's face it, ghost hunting is not really accepted by the scientific community yet. We feel it is a developing science. Science is just now starting to take a look at some of this stuff, but it's not accepted yet, and we hope we are contributing to what is probably a developing science.
Well, it definitely helps at some level to be able to legitimize things with facts versus more emotion or you know, things of that level. And I've wondered when a client gets in touch with you and your organization, your team shows up, they do the work, they make the report, and they say, yes, you actually have something in this house.
Mm-hmm.
How do you resolve what is there? I mean, is it a move out of the house situation?
Well, we actually had one client that actually did, because she had so much activity in her house. She did 2 weeks after she contacted us, pack up, move out, broke her lease, didn't care, because she was so frightened in that house. And that for us is still sort of an ongoing investigation. We've not really come to a final conclusion. Although we did get some evidence, there was a lot of other issues going on in that house, so that were explainable. But I don't know, did that answer your question?
It did, you know, and it actually surprised me that someone packed up and moved out, but I guess if there's enough there to give you the heebie-jeebies, then, you know, you're going to pack up and move on.
Right. Well, we do educate people as we go, too. We do give them, you know, we'll give them our conclusion, and we do find evidence of paranormal activity. We also empower them with knowledge as to here's what you can do about it. Here are some possible solutions. We do also offer to do house blessings. We have done several of those with some pretty good results. So
when you give them these options, what are some of the more typical or standard or less exotic options that someone could do?
Well, the house blessing is one of them. You know, prayer is another, depending on the person's belief system. You know, so there are several things people can do. And one of the things is just really we educate them, because knowledge, is, as we all know, is empowering. And I think for a lot of people, when you're educated about something, you're less fearful of it. And for some people, it's a matter of letting them know that they absolutely can take control. When they get these feelings that there's somebody there and they're frightened, what I tell them is before you go getting fearful, get angry. It's no different than if a perfect stranger were to walk in off the street and just barge into your house. You're going to go, "What are you doing here? Get out of here!" You know, and get angry with these people if they're bothering you or disturbing you. These spirits or ghosts, you know, let them know that they're not welcome in your home. That this is your home and you want them out. And you'd be surprised at the results that something that simple can bring for people. A little bit of peace of mind, knowing that they actually can take control of the situation if they're frightened. I tell them absolutely don't be fearful, especially if they think there are negative energies or entities around them, because negative energies and entities feed off of that emotion of fear.
When these discoveries are made and the analysis is done, typically are the ghost or the spirit or whatever, are they there because of where the location is or because of who the residents are?
Well, it could be either one. Sometimes we don't know why ghosts or spirits hang around a particular place. You know, sometimes they develop an attachment to the location. Maybe it could be a former resident that lived there for many years, or former owner of the house, and they just have a particular attachment to that location. Could be maybe a particular item in the home. Sometimes they'll develop attachments to items, especially with regards to antique things or things that are very old. There's a lot of speculative theory as to why a place might have paranormal activity. And sometimes it is the person, too. I lived in a couple different houses when I was a child that I do feel had paranormal activity because of my experiences. Even now, as an adult looking back on it, I do feel that those places had paranormal activity. However, at some point in my life, I realized that not every place I lived in had paranormal activity. It's me, because I am sensitive, and I do sense those things much easier than some people do.
I wanted to revisit the GhostPro investigative equipment, because you gave a great overview of the cameras, the meters and the computers and sensors and this type of stuff. One of the things on the list that jumped out at me, and I've heard of these forever, I didn't know they actually existed from a utility standpoint, that they worked, dowsing rods.
Dowsing rods, yes. Dowsing rods is an ancient form of divination, as a way to contact spirits. It goes back thousands of years. Native tribes have used them for years. Farmers have used them for years as a way to locate water. Initially, you know, they were used that way. But dowsing rods also can detect paranormal activity. Now, I don't have a lot of experience with them. One of the other ladies in our group, Mariel, is our dowsing expert, and she actually trained with some of the top experts in the field. But she uses them. I've experimented with them a few times. It's very interesting thing, because you know you'll ask questions or you'll say, "Point me to this or that or whatever," and the rods will actually turn and point. And you can feel the rods. You can feel the tug on the rods. It's very unique thing. So yes, we do use dowsing rods in our in some of our investigations.
Why don't you give us some contact information? Anyone in the audience that wants to get a hold of you, whether it's phone numbers or web address or email, hit us up with all that stuff.
Okay, our website is www.ghostpro.org. You can contact us either through our info line, which is info@ghostpro.org, or you can contact me at cat@ghostpro.org.
Our guest this morning has been Catherine Vinson with the GhostPro organization, which stands for Paranormal Research Organization. And on this day before Halloween, we thought we'd talk a little bit about ghosts and spirits. Catherine, it's been great. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for the opportunity, Larry.
Upstate Issues is a public affairs presentation of Intercom Communications. This is Larry Wilson, and we'll see you next week.